so crazy, but what am I to do? Crazy me, hanging around your door and asking every daisy to tell me what's the score.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories from Tinseltown. And today we have a really good one. And I know you guys, I got a lot of people asking me to let me know when I do this episode, because there's a lot of interest in this woman who you would think not, but there is. So today I am talking to one of her he wrote an autobiography on Carol, called Carol Landis, A Most Beautiful Girl, and it's part of the Hollywood Legend series. And we are speaking to Mr. Eric Ganz. Thanks, Eric, for coming on.
Well, thank you. It'll be fun to talk about Carol.
Yeah, I love your book. You wrote it 10 years ago. I got it on Kindle, and I read it and enjoyed it. And can you just tell us what inspired you to write a book about Carol?
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, I'm not a Hollywood biographer. And in fact, you know, I was a professor of French at UCLA.
Oh, French.
It has really little to do with Carol Landis, although she did love Paris. But I taught film. I taught French film for 20 years at UCLA. But I never taught American film, really, although, you know, sort of sensitized me to film, let's say. I had to learn film techniques, and I always made sure that the students learned about film techniques a little bit before showing them any movies, because, you know, as you know better than I probably, the cinema has all kinds of technical elements that aren't obvious to the naive viewer, you know, like just the question of what is a shot and so on, and the different ways of moving the camera. So anyway, but aside from that, you know, but then one evening, my wife and I think it was in 2002, were watching this, you know, old movies on TCM, and we came across this movie called I Wake Up Screaming with Betty Grable and Victor Mature, and it also had as the kind of center of the plot, although if you know the story,
yes,
she wasn't. Well, then you know that she's the first shot that you see of her, she's already dead.
So
the
yeah,
whole flashback. But in any case, we watched this movie, and I said, gee, I know, who is that beautiful woman? I can't, you know. I've always liked old movies, but I know, you know, didn't recall ever having seen her. I mean, I knew the name, but it was just a name, you
right,
know. And I probably could have dredged up somewhere in my memory that she had committed suicide, although, you know, I wasn't a Hollywood kind of fan. That
yeah.
Thinking. So anyway, we watched this movie, and I thought, I'd never seen anyone quite so beautiful. And it inspired me to, you know, look at a number of her other movies and then, you know, check different aspects of her life. I realized there wasn't that much about her. No one had written a book about her until Mr. Fleming wrote his year before mine. But, you know, there were chapters about here and there. But the point is that I was fascinated, and I've always been somehow fascinated by beautiful actresses, but never quite to this point. And you know, I eventually watched all her feature films and quite a few of the Warner Brothers films that she made earlier that had just bit parts. And I studied up on her, and I spent years researching this. I used to go to the USC library, which has a better collection of these things than the UCLA library. They have a huge collection of old movie magazines. And
ooh, great stuff.
And I read just about every article on her, including all those old gossip columns, you know, like Hedda Hopper.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So, I mean, I say I did more research for this than I did for my doctoral dissertation.
And you are proud of this, as you should be.
Well, I am, because, you know, it was like a kind of a labor of love. I felt that this was a woman who hadn't really received the recognition she deserved. And the more I learned about her, the more I was impressed with her, not only for her physical beauty, which was extraordinary, but her personal generosity. And, you know, during the war, she had probably the best war record of all. Of course, there were others like Martha Ray or even Bob Hope. But the point is that she really devoted herself to the war effort. She went to both theaters of war. Her Four Jills group was the only all-woman group to go abroad to entertain the troops in the whole World War II. And then she went back to the Pacific Theater somewhat later with Jack Benny and so on. So she, you know, she was a very generous person. There's a great shot. I'm sorry we're on the radio here. You can't see the illustrations in my book, but there's a great shot of her that was published in Life magazine of her and Fayard Nicholas. I assume you know who Fayard Nicholas was.
No.
Oh, well, he was a black dancer. He was in this, he and his brother, I can't remember the name of his brother, who was a less exciting name than Fayard, but in any case, the Nicholas brothers were a big act in those days. They had very athletic dancing style. And in particular, in one of her films called Orchestra Wives, which has some people know that film because it had Glenn Miller in it. He only, I think, made two films in Hollywood. But in any case, she was singing in Mississippi. You know, she toured the country. She didn't just go abroad. She went all over the country during the war, entertaining the troops in all kinds of places. And she was in Mississippi. And she found out, I don't know how, but she learned that he was there as a soldier. And, of course, in those days, he was in a different part of, you know, he was in the black
segregation,
area.
Segregation, yeah.
Yeah, because it was all segregated. Well, she went and got him out of where he was and took him up on stage with her. And there's a great shot of the two of them standing. It's in my book.
Yes,
it was published
in
Life magazine. There's a great shot of her and Nicholas.
Good for
and,
her.
You know, I started my project a little too late to really get to know Carol's friends and family. It was, you know, I should have thought of it 20 years earlier, but in any case, so most of those people had already gone, but he was still alive. He was in his 90s, and I managed to speak to him on the phone. And he, as I recall, he said to me, you know, she didn't have a prejudice bone in her body. So that's just an example. I don't want to say that, you know, she was. The point is that she was a generous person. Everyone who remembered her spoke of her with affection as somebody who was kind and generous and loving. And
you know, cheerful, and yes.
The tragedy being that she couldn't put it together to have a happy family life. She was too restless somehow.
I'm going to stop you here, Eric, so that we can,
sure, can
talk
go
about...
On for a...
yeah, we just want to get to her. Perhaps what drove her later in life is her childhood years. She didn't have a very good one, that's for sure. So you want to give us a little info on her childhood and how she getting into all this stuff?
Sure. Well, she was born in Wisconsin, but in a sense, that's misleading. That was where her mother was from.
Mm-hmm.
But her mother had lived there with her father for a short time, but then they went to Montana. And the reason that Carol and then her husband left to go to California to be in the Navy, this was toward the end of World War One. So Carol was born in Wisconsin because her mother came back home in order to have her. Presumably, she didn't want to have her kid in Montana where her husband wasn't there and so on. And her parents lived in Wisconsin, so she had her child there, and then but they didn't live there very long, and she moved back to she separated from her husband. She moved back to Montana for a while, And then she separated and she remarried this guy in Montana. And then she divorced him and she went to San Diego to be with her husband and with her husband, but she never remarried him, but she went back to the guy who was Carol's father. There's even a question whether he was
I read that.
Father.
Yeah.
I know people like Mr. Fleming would like to think that he wasn't. Well, there's certainly plenty of reason to believe that, you know, Carol's mother was clearly not exactly
stable.
She seemed to go from one man to another.
Because
there isn't much evidence. He was obviously a kind of, adventurous person. I think the last picture I saw of her when she was in her 70s, she was riding a snowmobile or something. You know, she was
Carol's mother.
A character. But in any case, so she went to San Diego to be with Alfred, her husband, and then after a very short time, they went to San Bernardino, and that's where Carol was brought up. Her mother was living alone in San Bernardino. Alfred, was there for a while, but he left, and it was a very unstable family. So she was bringing up her kids in San Bernardino, and that's where Carol grew up and went to high school, and it was from there that she left to go to San Francisco to start her career.
Eric, how many siblings did she have?
She had two brothers and a sister, but they're both, she had three brothers, and a sister. She had one brother who, was older. He was born in 1912, so he was 7 years older. Mm-hmm. And then she had her older sister, Dara, but they had another little boy who was born, I think, in 1917, but he died as a baby in some kind of unfortunate accident where they said he was scalded by the water for laundry. I guess he kind of fell.
Horrible.
Yeah, it sounds horrible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then she had another little brother who died in a kind of a silly accident where some kids were playing with a gun and somebody shot it and didn't realize it was loaded. And so he just.
Jeez.
And this was when she was about four. And
what a life.
But the one that really counted for her was her older sister. She was, born in 1917, so she was just a little bit older than Carol. But she was with her all her life. And it was from her. When you talk about Carol's family, you're really talking about Dorothy's family. That she... I managed to meet three of her children.
Dorothy's children?
Of Dorothy's children, yes. Unfortunately, though, the one that was sort of Carol's favorite had died earlier of cancer. But I did meet the three survivors, they're all Mormons now. So,
wow.
because the gentleman who married his sister converted to LDS, and so... although they're originally Catholics, so they all live in Utah. So I took a trip to Provo and met Walt Ross, who was Dorothy's, eldest son.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were very nice about letting me see some Carol materials. They had a couple of tubs full of old letters and things, and I went through those for a few days, stayed in a hotel. In a motel in Provo and went through that stuff. And they gave me an interesting picture also of how Carol, how assiduous she was with her correspondence. She had many correspondents during the war, soldiers that had seen her. And she always answered them.
She was wonderful with that.
She was. And in fact, in many cases, the people would answer her saying, I'm sorry, I didn't answer your letter. They were saying to her that they were sorry that they hadn't answered her letter right away. I mean, in other words, she didn't act like the star. It was her who, she was the one who kept up the correspondence. Of course, they were busy fighting the war. I'm not going to.
Yeah, but let me write to Carol right now.
I wish I could, you know, but she's put after it, you know. Unfortunately, there's something that's wonderful about that. If you read all those letters, you see how she was loved by people, not just because she was pretty, but because there was something that she gave to them. And it's even a little bit sad. She was even a little sad at the end of the war. Obviously, she didn't want the war to continue, but there was a sense in which it gave her life more
purpose,
meaning
than
playing in B roles in Fox films.
Yeah.
So anyway, she was brought up in San Bernardino. She went to high school, although she didn't do very well, and I somehow wonder if she ever even graduated. Unfortunately, they wouldn't show me her records because they had some kind of privacy rule. I said, you know, this woman died 70 years ago. What do you mean privacy?
Oh, well, you know. It's going to go on her permanent record. What I read on the family website is that because didn't she get married at 15? And
yeah, she ran away to Yuma, Arizona with Irving Wheeler. That was her first husband. She actually married him twice because her parents got that one, or her mother got that one annulled, but then she went back later. Apparently her father gave her permission, so she married him again. But none of her marriages were successful. One of the reasons, I think, was that she couldn't have children. Still, that doesn't mean that that's not exactly an explanation. But
no,
then he was, you know, just sort of a...
He was
nice,
a kid. She wanted
more.
Yeah,
he was a kid. Had a car, I think that was...
And then they ended up moving in with his mother. I'm sure that was a thrill.
Right.
And so she left him. Exactly. I'm out of here. And she moved on. And she was very tall and sort of well-built, very young, right?
Tall. She was tall for her day. If you look at her in pictures, she's about 5'6". If you compare her with, say, Alexis Smith, who was 5'9", I think, you know, today she wouldn't look that tall, but in her day...
There were a lot of shrimps out there.
the blue and all that. She was, she was tall for her time. And she had the most beautiful figure probably ever, really, if you want to talk about having a narrow waist and a full bosom
and she was all natural, totally natural.
Yeah, well, I mean, she did have a nose job, but they didn't do bosom enhancement in those days, so you can be sure that it was all real.
Carol.
But she didn't just have, you know, a great figure. She had a kind of a sexual self-confidence that I've never seen in anybody else.
Really?
You know, you watch certain movies where she plays, the one that I always talk about is this rather silly film called Having Wonderful Crime. And it's not a, you know, great film by any means, but there's really this great scene at the beginning, you know, where she comes and she's with a couple of men, her husband and this lawyer that they're kind of playing around with, who was the hero, Pat O'Brien. But anyway, they come into this theater, and she sits down in the second row, and she's wearing this huge hat, you know, one of these big black hats with a huge rim. And then she leans over and to the woman who's sitting right in front of her with a much smaller hat and asks her to move her hat. You can see the... Meanwhile, the woman in back of her can't see anything because she's wearing this great hat. But, you know, who could pull that off? You know, she pulls it off because she's just so beautiful and so at ease with her beauty. And she's like someone who descended from another planet. I've never seen any other actress who could pull that off.
Wow.
Marilyn Monroe does certain things and so on, but there's just no comparison, really.
Wow.
It's a shame that they didn't exploit this more in the movies. That was her strong point, and she could have made many movies like that. But, anyway.
Anyway, so she went to San Francisco.
Right, she went
rather than L.A. Why was that? Why would she go to San Francisco?
Well, you know, she explained it that she didn't want to compete with all the girls in L.A. and that she was, she wanted to start off, kind of at a distance from Hollywood. But, you know, none of that sounds very convincing. one could speculate that maybe there was some guy that took her there, you know?
Yes.
I mean, well, she was not shy about sexuality. I'm not sure if she knew that she couldn't have children, but I get the feeling she did because, you know, in those days, they didn't have the pill and, you know, sex was always a kind of a dangerous thing because you could get pregnant. And I have a feeling that she somehow realized that she wouldn't, and so it made her much more willing to, you know. So I'm not sure, but let's just say that there isn't any terribly clear explanation, and that sounds like a rationalization to me.
No, but you're also speculating in the book. I don't know where you got that. Maybe Hollywood Babylon, that she was a call girl, but she wouldn't have thought of it that way, that she would go out with guys and they'd give her gifts or something like that.
Well, that's when she got to San Francisco. I never called her. No, she wasn't a call girl or a prostitute. But, you know, she was, I called her essentially a kind of party girl or good time. I mean, she didn't do that professionally. That was sort of a way of augmenting her income. She was a dancer and,
right?
Yeah, well, she started out as a hula dancer and then she got a job as a singer, you know. She had a very nice voice. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard her sing.
I don't think I have. Did she?
Well, she had a great contralto voice, which added to her sexiness. Not too many attractive women have a deep voice like that, but it's very... you know, it makes a real effect on the listener. But in any and she sings very nicely. And but in any case, that was what she was doing. I mean, it's not as though she was just living off prostitution. But of course, if she was introduced to some guy and he took her out for dinner and then they slept together, he might leave her a little gift or something. I mean, I think that, you know, that's not quite the same as
no, it's kind of the same, but not really. You know, it's kind of. I don't know. It's not the same, but it's
well. I mean, it's
close.
Like you know, gentlemen prefer blondes and the kind of thing where you know what is that song? If a mad attack means a Cadillac, okay, you know that one.
Yeah. How old was she when she was in San Fran?
Well, she was about. She went there, I guess she was about 17. She was, this was in 35, 36. It was 16, 17. And then she came, but she went to L.A. in 37, as I recall. And there, because she met this girl in San Francisco who had worked in Hollywood, who was actually a makeup person. But anyway, she worked in Hollywood, and then Carol came back to L.A. and got a place, you know, a rented room and started making the rounds of the studios. And she got into Warner. And, I mean, I don't remember the exact date. You could probably tell me. But it was in 1937. Mm-hmm. And she played in... she didn't have any really good roles for Warner. She just was a bit actress. She was in Chorus Line. And she did appeal to Berkeley, but Busby, and there was at least some rumors that the two of them were going to get married and so on. But according to sources, his mother, as they say, put the kibosh on that
because of her reputation or something.
Well, she was actually still married to Irving Wheeler at the time.
Oh, that's right. He was suing Busby Berkeley for like $250,000, I think, for alienation of her affection. I read that.
Yeah, but...
yeah, that was going to go.
I don't think he got anything out of that. Yeah, but in any case, let's just say that her past was a little bit, you know, for in those days, a girl was, maybe she wasn't a virgin, but, you know, you didn't want... I don't know if you noticed in my book, there was this little passage from Jimmy Starr that I wished I could have quoted directly, but I was told by the people at Mississippi that I couldn't because it was too racy, shall I say, where Jimmy Starr describes an evening that he spent with Carol in San Francisco and certain sexual activities that took place and so on. But, that seemed to me to be, I'm sure he wasn't making that up. In fact, he was always very friendly with Carol.
She was very young, and you have to give her that.
She was young, but the point is, she didn't look at sex as something that, she had to make a fuss about. It was just sort of natural to her, and I'm not sure to what extent she was sort of oversexed, but she certainly never, she wasn't a prude, let's put it that way. And if she spent the night or the evening with some guy and went back to her room, I'm sure she wouldn't, So the point was that he talked about how skillful she was, but also, just the sense of that she was someone enjoyable to be with. She wasn't. The thing about Carol was that she wasn't sluttish in any way. She just was so beautiful. She didn't have to act sexy. I think that there's a kind of, that's one thing about really beautiful women that I've always found attractive. They know they're beautiful, so you don't have to, They don't have to put on extra makeup and wiggle and so on.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was her great charm. That was something that I think she Hollywood could have taken more advantage of, but, it didn't fit in with the normal, if you read my book, she was, in a sense, too beautiful for Hollywood. She distracted people from the storyline. And
do you think that? Because there are so many beautiful women of that era.
Not quite like Carol. I don't think there's anybody... really never been anybody quite as sexy and just all in all.
Well, that's your opinion, Eric. Other people will have a disagreement with you. You find
well,
her
in
to
the
be,
day, when she was around, that was generally the way people talked about her. But now, sure, there are plenty of beautiful actresses. I could name quite a few. In fact, I'm a big fan of beautiful actresses. But, Carol had a kind of sexiness that really, the 40s, things were a little different. It wasn't the Marilyn Monroe kind of...
over-the-top, va-va-va.
Well, it was sort of a campy, right? Monroe was... Well, Carol was pre-camp. It was just, you were just sexy and that was it. There was, and especially during the war, there wasn't any time to be playing around. You might get killed the next day. So, but the point is, regardless of how, what you think might be unprejudiced, let's just say that that was the point that I tried to make of why she was less successful than she might have been. She was, that kind of beauty is hard to put in film. That's why I was interested in that first film I saw, because she was dead at the beginning of the film, you see.
I like that film. I've only seen, I think I've only seen two of her movies. I've seen that
really?
One, I Wake Up Screaming, and I the first time I saw her, and I didn't know anything about her, I saw her in Topper, the second one, where she, the real lead was Joan Blondell. Yeah.
An old Hal Roach thing. Well, that was...
She was stunning. That she really did. I was like, who is she? And I had to look her up because I really found her to be incredibly beautiful and I didn't know who she was.
Well, that's the... that was my impression of her too. But unfortunately, that movie was already kind of, for other Hal Roach films, she was really the star. In that one, she was playing sort of a third fiddle to Joan Blondell and so on. So... I mean, it's a well-done film. It was made with better production values than the other ones. But in the other one, she was the star at the center of the action, and there she was basically auxiliary to...
Yes, and like Betty Grable was the star of I Wake Up Screaming, but
yeah, sure.
I thought Carol Landis was fabulous in that. And then did you ever see the remake of it with Gene Peters and who was it?
Yeah, Vicky,
yeah.
Vicky, in many ways, is the better film because, first of all, it has Jean Crane and so on. Jean Crane is, if you want to talk about beautiful actresses, I've admired her. She had a kind of purity. You remember her in that O. Henry thing about the...
The hair, cutting the hair and the other... And
yeah, he, right.
For him to get the pocket for his watch.
The magi. Yeah, that's...
Gift of the Magi, yeah.
But, a very different kind of beauty. Like if you watch her sing I'm Restless as a Willow in a Windstorm from in the State Fair, you know, there's something, you know, Carol wouldn't be able to do that. But, you know, it's a different kind of beauty. But in any case, you know, when Peters was a little more, I don't want to say sluttish. But,
yeah,
you know,
she was a little more coarse.
About her, yeah. That Carol didn't have. And in a way, she was better suited for that role. The thing I didn't like about the movie is that her role is kind of nasty. I mean, she's not very nice to people. You know, she takes advantage of them. And,
yeah, the guys are all in love, and she uses them all.
That's right.
And you know, but that's a good
herself.
You gotta spread your wings and not just be one part if you want to really be. And she probably wanted to be a different kind of actress. Do some drama, do some comedy, do some music. And a lot of times you don't get that. But I wanted to ask you, so her first real film that got her, and it did the same for Raquel Welch, was 100
million
years BC or something? What is it? Is that the name of it?
Well,
the caveman one?
Yeah, a million BC. That was her first starring role for a major studio, or if you want to call Roach a major studio. I mean, she had starred in a couple of westerns in her Republic days and the year before, including one with John Wayne, by the way. But, you know, that was before John Wayne was
became John Wayne, that big old John Wayne, yeah.
I mean, he was already starting to get known, but, he's still working for Republic.
Yeah.
For Republic later. I don't know. I haven't followed his career that well. But in any case, that's kind of a nice little film. But yeah, A Million BC was her first real film. And, you know, it was remade with Raquel Welch. And then more recently, if you want to talk about the history of those films, there was a film called 10,000 BC with Camilla Bell. I don't know if you know who she is.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, she's a particularly beautiful young lady. But in any case, her original one is the best of these. Anyway, I can't say I've seen them all. There have been quite a few of these.
I've never seen that. TCM, I'm sure it's shown it, but I've yet to see
one,
the BC.
Well, her BC one. Well, I mean, it was kind of an original idea. They had these sort of... instead of having CGI, which they couldn't afford, and in those days it was pretty primitive anyway, you know, but having something like King Kong, mm-hmm. after all. King Kong was, what, 1933, but they managed to make a kind of fake, Well, they used photographs of lizards, which were kind of blown up so they would look like dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a clever idea.
In some of these things, when I see some of the stuff that they do, it's amazing, yet it looks fake to me. I go, give me the magnifying glass with the grasshopper. And I think they did really well for the time, actually.
Sure.
So,
well, frankly, after you've seen people throwing locomotives at each other for a while, you get kind of bored with that, right? I mean, you know, with CGI, you can do anything, but then that's also the same as saying you could do nothing because it's just imagery. Like when you see, war scenes, there used to be a cast of 1,000. Now it's a cast of 0 because it's all done with, with CGI. But it loses its,
it loses the reality, the realism. Because, Memorial Day weekend, TCM had all war movies. And they're pretty, some of them are just amazing. And one of my favorite films is about the after effects of war, The Best Years of Our Lives, which is an amazing film.
Oh, that's
film.
A great film. Yeah.
They all were just magnificent in that. It was a great, great film. But I want to ask you, so what happened to Carol, her love life? What happened? What was going on then?
What happened to her when?
What was her love life like?
Oh, her love life. Well, I had a list on my old website, I'm not sure I could find it anymore, of various men who were talked about as her, escorts, if you like.
George Jessel.
She went out with dozens of guys, and, I don't know what she did with them afterward, and it's not really my business, but let's say she was you know, an item with, you know, maybe 50, 60 different men.
Yeah, I have this list here. Georgie Jessel, you wrote about him. That's a surprise.
Well, Georgie Jessel mentioned her in his autobiography, and he was a sort of obnoxious character. I don't know. He was, you know, the toastmaster of USA.
Oh, yeah, I never knew who he was, really. Oh, she did. I read that she was really hurt. I don't know how serious this was or whatever, but I'm reading here. Carol and actor Franch Othone had a serious romance in 1940, and yeah, they remained just close friends. But she was pretty hurt by him dumping her, right?
Well, yeah, so that was one of her more, well, tragic is hardly the word, but yeah, that was one of her more unhappy experiences, I think.
Why did he dump her? Didn't he?
Well, I think a lot of men, you know, because of her reputation, but not just reputation, I mean, because of the fact that she was sort of unstable in these love relationships. That's something I can't pretend to know intimately, you know, since I couldn't talk to her or even anyone who really knew her. She was clearly not somebody that you could rely on, you know. She would you know, throw herself at you, and God knows she might have been a very good sex partner, but the point is that you couldn't count on her to have any kind of stability. She was a kind of restless person, and I imagine living with her must have been
a nightmare. Not fun.
I don't know. It's hard to say because, you know, if you look at all these marriages, she never really lived with her husband more than a month or two.
That is amazing to me. Let's talk about hubby number two. When did she marry him and who was he?
Willis Hunt. Yeah, well, he was somebody who supplied boats to Hollywood people and so on. So we kind of hung around the fringes of Hollywood and yeah, they were married in, well, I don't know, you can tell me what year by now. I don't even remember. It was around 1939 or something. I mean, I don't have a timeline for her right on the
her dudes.
But in any case, yeah, they were married sometime around 1939, I think. But, yeah, he was, you know, that was a good example. I mean, he seemed like a fairly distinguished guy. Certainly, he was more distinguished than Irving Wheeler, and he, you know, but they stayed married only a couple of months, and then a couple of months later, she was suing for divorce. And
I know here, it is. Yeah, Landis left town after 2 months of marriage. Yeah, that's it.
Well, the thing is, he wasn't happy being the husband of a movie star, but then you wonder, why would you marry a movie star if you don't like being a husband of a movie star?
Yeah, I guess people don't really get what that's going to entail once you do it, because you really get shoved aside, and, you know, men have a harder time with that. Women have done that forever, you know, sort of being shoved aside with their husbands who are the stars, but I think men have, for their egos, it's a harder thing for them to deal with, but I don't think that's the reason that, you know, I think that she's looking for something and she never, ever would have found it. You know, she's just looking for love. And yet she always.
That's why I said in my book, the only man with whom she seems to have had a really satisfactory love relationship, and that's obviously because they were married, was Rex Harrison. And I find, you know, I'm sorry that her family or whatever, you know, people, some of her fans, you know, accuse him of killing her.
Let's get to that later, because that's a juicy
one. I mean, aside
one.
From even that, you know, that stuff, they're very hostile to him. Carol fans tend to hate Rex Harrison. He was the only man that, with whom she really enjoyed life. I mean, they had a pretty good relationship that lasted a pretty good amount of time.
Yes, and he was a married man. She knew that, so whatever. Anyway, let's get into her relationship, allegedly, with one of the big heads of studios.
The Zanuck thing.
Yes.
Well, that's the business that Milton Sperling said that she would visit him in his office, for, you know, in the afternoon and so on. Well, you know, I'm ready to believe that. As I say, she was not the kind of girl who would prudery intervene. I'm sure Vizanek was pretty forceful at, getting her to put out and so on. And I don't think she was the sort of person who made a big fuss about that. And maybe she would have done better to have more of a strategy and so on. I don't know. But, I mean, I'm ready to believe that if they said that, obviously people exaggerated to the point where they assumed that she was in there every day of the week for 10 years. But I'm sure that he took advantage of her, as he did of so many people. This was the year of the casting couch. But what was sad about it was that she obviously didn't play her cards very well, considering that she never got any really good roles with Fox.
No. So she was going to get one, and there's a rumor. What's the name of the one? Rita Hayworth got it instead. And why they said she didn't get it was she wouldn't dye her hair red or something.
Well, that's the story, too, that probably isn't true. But it's Blood and Sand.
Yes, with Tyrone Power. And that would have been a good movie for her.
It's possible that, Carol, she said that she'd become a blonde and she didn't want to switch around.
I don't believe that's true. I heard the rumor that he put the kibosh on that. What's his face? Zanuck.
It sounds like the kind of thing that the Hollywood fixtures would make up to explain something. But, it's hard to believe that she would turn down a...
She can dye her hair right back. It's silly.
Well, she did. I mean, let's face it, she spent half of her career with blonde hair and the other half with dark hair. I mean, it's certainly...
Towards the end of her career.
No, in any case. No, but if you remember in my book, I do bring up the fact that she was, at the time, it wasn't any question of Rita Hayworth. The person who was supposed to have that role was Hedy Lamarr, and so Carol didn't, at least at some chance, that she might have said that she didn't want to appear as a sort of a substitute for Hedy Lamarr. I don't know. But in any case... No, it seems unlikely that if they had really offered her that role, that she would have turned it down. So even whatever excuses she gave are probably something that the studio told her to say.
Yes. So then she decided, like you have talked about earlier, she went, when the war started, she got her butt out. And she really did. She worked and she traveled. The Four Jills and a Jeep, that was Kay Francis, other one.
Sarah and Martha Ray.
Yeah. And like you said, she worked her butt off and she went to all these places and entertained. And it was amazing what she did. I mean, she really got out there and gave it all. And she also got amoebic dysentery, which they said she probably didn't. Malaria, and they think that she never really recovered from that.
Well, that was in the South Pacific. That was the second trip. Not that wasn't the Jill's trip.
Yeah.
But she had her share of health problems during her life. I'm not sure exactly, I don't have a medical report, but I mean...
You couldn't even get her high school thing to say that she quit high school.
Well, yeah, I looked through all the... I actually went to San Bernardino and looked at all the yearbooks of her high school, but she didn't have her picture in any of them. So I have a feeling... I think she dropped out after her second or maybe third year, but she certainly, almost certainly didn't graduate. But in any case... Yeah, she was very assiduous about going around, as I say, I think she sort of didn't do too much. There was something kind of hyper about her, She would dance and sing and so on, and I have a feeling that she never quite took care of herself the way she should have.
And perhaps she wasn't very reflective. She kept busy so that she wouldn't really have to think that much sometimes. There are people like that, that they don't want to do it. But also on her travels, she met her third husband.
Yes, Tommy Wallace, who was, a nice young guy. And by the way, since I wrote the book, my friend Gwen Cerna, who is Carol's best fan, came up with some correspondence that we hadn't seen at the time with a soldier later in the war, but it led us to think that she, you know, she probably had more little love affairs with these guys than we knew at the time, because, you know, not everything gets into print, of course. But she, you know, a couple of letters that she had written some fellow that suggested that they had had a certain amount of, you know,
rendezvous. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not obvious when you're traveling around like that exactly, you know, whether you get to sort of sleep with the guys. But in any case, you know, one gets the impression that she was just kind of impulsive and she couldn't, she, you know, lacked a certain type of self-control of kind of doing the best thing for herself. She wasn't. Yeah. She just sort of trusted her intuition, and that creates some wonderful moments, but it doesn't really guarantee you a very good career. I mean, if you think about the way someone like Betty Davis operated, you know, this is just the opposite of that.
There's no
sort of a strategy in Carol's activities. She would just sort of, you know, decide to do something, and, you know, that's why she couldn't maintain any kind of
relationship or her career, you know, no, sort of. So with her third husband, she met him when she was performing.
Right.
And they went out and had drinks one night with other people?
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, yeah.
They got engaged quickly, though, right?
Yeah, they got engaged, and then she you know, even managed to get a church wedding because her previous marriages hadn't been officially sanctioned by the church, and and this was, of course, a great moment for publicity. I certainly don't think she did it for that, but it, you know, it was something that was in the film papers and so on. That you know, star
Mary's war hero and
marrying a soldier, airman, and so on. But, you know, like all her other marriages, and there were some very nice letters between the two. There's one thing I found a couple of in papers that I looked at in Provo. But, you know, there was a tender relationship, but, you know,
they weren't
really
together.
Yeah, they weren't together, so they never really had a chance to
know each other.
Right. But there's also the fact that he also resented being the husband of a star. No, you're right. That, and you know, today men take care of their children and they even change diapers. But you know, even when I was had a child, my wife did most of the diaper changing. You know, things have changed a lot. But in any case, yeah, he, you know, he resented that. And
so after the war, he lived with her for a little while, and then it was time for a divorce.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, you know, that's the same pattern over and over, really. I mean, regardless, the men were all rather different from each other, but the result was the same, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, and you got to look at Carol. So you say, what's up with Carol? Because she obviously makes these decisions, and you know, like a lot of actresses said, oh, all I want is home and hearth. Yet, could you see that with her? No, I couldn't see her with home and hearth. She couldn't live with a guy for a month. You know,
well, and her case was perhaps more extreme than most, even though you have a lot of, I remember you interviewed some guy talking about Barbara Payton, you know.
Right, but, wow. Oof.
Well, she was a kind of a caricature of Carol, but there was something, in the very fact of wanting to be on screen and the sort of expedition.
Exactly. That's a whole, it's a whole different mindset to put yourself out there and go to Hollywood and, you know, bang Mr. Zanuck and do all of that stuff because you want to be a star. And, you know, like Betty Davis stopped for a while when she married Gary Merrill. And they moved to Maine, and then she came back and did other movies. I mean, she couldn't stay there forever. No, you know, it's just a whole different life. And perhaps they really believe that.
It takes someone like Jean Crane, whom I mentioned. You know, I don't know about her, but apparently she had a very stable marriage.
Six kids. Yes, she was supposed to be
a good Catholic.
Yeah.
You know.
But, yes, and she was supposed to be.
But you know, you can tell. I think on screen, you know, the way actresses act on screen gives you a pretty good idea of how they are in person. You could see when you see Jean Crane, she's just the kind of girl you want to marry, right? She's not, you know, she's not the sort of sexy
vixen. No, she's lovely. She's beautiful, but she's not like a vixen kind of person. Betty Davis, I can't see anybody wanting to marry her or Joan Crawford.
Betty Davis was very cute back in the 30s.
Yeah, but come on, even her characters then, the 40s, the whole thing. And Joan, she was very cute in the 30s, actually, but they were strong personalities that shone through.
Oh, yeah,
both of them.
She was thinking of a dragon lady. I don't think I would have wanted to marry Betty Davis.
I think she was even worse than Joan.
In Crane myself.
Six kids.
And I certainly wouldn't have tried to marry Carol. My only fantasy with Carol is that I would have been like Cesar Romero, her best friend. Of course, he was gay. But
yes. Was it widely known that Cesar was gay then?
Probably not. No, because they didn't make a thing. Well, you know, they say Cary Grant and so. I mean, no, they didn't. You know, they kept those things hidden. In fact, you know, I'm sure you've heard more stories than I have. There's stories about Clark Gable.
I just heard one about Gary Cooper. I'm like, man, you know.
Gary Cooper? I never heard anything gay about
him. I didn't either, but until recently.
He was supposed to have been a pretty, you know, virile person.
He was a gorgeous guy, but they said early in his career.
He was known for his sexual athleticism.
With tons of chicks. I mean, his wife, she stayed with him. Anyway, so Carol left husband number three, and then she got to... The name kills me. Husband number four. How'd she meet this guy? Was this when she was still? She got to Broadway and she had an affair with Jacqueline Suzanne.
This thing called The Lady Says Yeah, Lady Says Yes, which it would be nice to hear some of the songs from it, but I don't think you can find a recording of it anywhere. Anyway, that was not a big success.
That's the one with Jacqueline Suzanne, right?
Excuse me?
She had the affair with Jacqueline Suzanne during that one, right?
Well, affair, yeah. I mean, Jacqueline Suzanne claimed that they had a sort of, you know, I'm not even know if the word affair is
a fling.
But, I mean, they, you know, there was a scene where she talks about them caressing each other's breasts and so on. Well, that's possible. I mean, I'm sure, as I say, Carol was no prude.
Yes.
And as for some, you know, she certainly wasn't a lesbian in the sense.
I think a lot of people did stuff in Hollywood. It was sort of like, oh well, who cares? You know what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my impression was that. There's something sort of touching about that relationship and the fact that the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes,
you know,
how sad with Jennifer North, the beautiful Sharon Tate, who she was supposed to, was based on Carol, allegedly. Yeah, that Suzanne wrote that about her.
Kind of touching about that.
Oh, very.
Carol was mentioned in the book, as I recall. There's a, you know, sort of a little hint, you know, sort of dropping her name in the book at the beginning, talking about how beautiful she was. No, I mean, there's something touching there. I think they had a real friendship.
Definitely.
You know, whether it involved anything really sexual, at least it was certainly tender.
And they were, you know, friends. So, yes. So then, is that where she met her final husband, and what a name, kids.
Yeah, Horace Midler. Well,
I can't.
Well, we shouldn't make fun of names.
But
you know,
I know.
Gans means goose in German.
I don't know.
He's Jewish. You know, they gave
Schmidlap. I had these girls. What was he? No, he was not a good looking man.
Oh, he was German. No, he wasn't. Well, he wasn't bad looking. I mean, you know,
I have to look at him.
I named Horace Schmidlap. You know, he was Cary Grant, let's say. But in any case, he was from a brewing family in Cincinnati. He was one of these guys who was a sort of son of someone who inherits some money, and so he was interested in show business, you know. I guess the caricature of these people was old Tommy Manville. I don't know if you remember him. Well, he was famous for having married 20 different women or something.
Really? Oh, yes, 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 Yes.
Yeah, he was, you know, that was all he was known for, but he'd married, you know, he was the male equivalent of Zsa Zsa Gabor or something, except, you know, he wasn't beautiful, he just had enough money to be able to, but, yeah, so he was a little bit of a playboy, but he was a serious guy. I mean, I don't know if he ever set up that TV business that he was trying to do in Yonkers, but, I mean, that at least he started it. I don't know if it ever really got off the ground because, obviously, after Carol's suicide, I didn't, follow up on the rest
Mr.
of it.
Mr. Schmidlap.
Yeah. Mr. Schmidlap. But we shouldn't make fun of him.
I can't help it. I'm not. But that, you know, because I've heard that name maybe in movies of the 30s or something, like they would call someone a Horace Schmidlap person. And when I read that she married a Horace Schmidlap, I just said, wow.
Schmidlap. Wealthy, unlike any of the others. And so she thought that this would be a way of having some kind of security, because you have to realize that all her life she was actually worried about money. She, she liked to buy clothes and things, and she didn't, her previous husbands had not been wealthy at all.
None.
She wasn't earning vast sums of money in the movies. I mean, she was doing okay, but she wasn't, at the top of the salary scale, and she had to, and she lived with her mother for a lot of this period. So, so she felt that he would be a source of security, and he got her this nice house in, it's not exactly Brentwood, but it's sort of halfway in between Brentwood and Pacific Palisades, which is the place where she committed suicide.
But they never really lived together either, right?
No.
He was from New York and...
Yeah. Right. I mean, they started... Well, the idea was that she was going to live in New York and fly out to Hollywood for movies, but then, that didn't quite work out. So, I can't tell you exactly how many days they spent living in the same house, but it couldn't have been very many, let's put it that way.
And so, then we come to Rex Harrison.
Yes, well, Rex Harrison, it's not exactly clear how they met, but in any case, they obviously hit it off well together, and they went together for something like a year, and when Carol went to England for the coronation, which, it's sort of an interesting and touching phenomenon, that if I ever got to speak to Queen Elizabeth, I would say, I wrote a book about Carol Landis. I wonder if she would remember her, because Carol certainly remembered meeting the two girls.
Was she queen yet? She was queen at that time? No. Elizabeth didn't become queen until
she
the
became,
50s, right?
She didn't become queen, no. But she was getting married
To Philip.
So her father was still alive. I'm not sure when he died, but he died after Carol. In any case, but she was. I think she became queen in 52. But she got married though to Prince Philip, and they're still married, for heaven's sake. And so there was a big celebration. This was in December of 47. Only a few months before her suicide. So she went to England, and she was working on these films in England, as you know. And so Rex was there, and, and Schmidlap, it wasn't clear whether he was going to come there or not. And she blamed him later for having gone to Switzerland or something and not, not in touch with her. But I imagine that Schmidlap didn't enjoy the idea of hanging around Carol when she was seeing Rex Harrison.
Right, because this was pretty well known. Everybody knew.
That was the thing. Yeah. Hollywood had gossip columns. If you didn't know it directly from some friend of yours, you could read about it in Variety, But... But she enjoyed that, and it was kind of a great moment for her. And Elizabeth and Margaret remembered her from Four Jills days, and she was very proud that she'd been introduced to royalty and so on. So she made her last two films in England, in part because I think she felt at home there. She felt they loved her there because they remembered her service during the war.
Yeah, she never just made it.
But that contributed to her affection for Rex.
And he was married to Lily Palmer? Is that her name?
Yes.
He was married to her.
Who was, I believe, Austrian.
I think she was in a movie with Fred Astaire or something later on. But she was very attractive.
What I always remember her in is the one whose title I never remember, where she plays the wife of this boxer played by John Garfield.
Yeah.
I always want to say it's The Harder They Fall.
Is it Body and Soul?
Maybe that's it, Body and Soul.
Yeah.
Isn't it made by this guy, this Jewish guy from New York?
Horace Schmidlap?
Met. that's a long time ago. Yeah, he went to City College. I remember this. Anyway, that's not important. But she was a kind of snappy person. And I imagine Rex wasn't terribly stable in his love life either.
No, he cheated all the time.
Yeah, he cheated, and then he had a couple of wives who committed suicide.
Yes, I read. I heard a story about Rex because I know people. It was the wife after Kay Kendall ended up having leukemia, and he wanted to marry Lily Palmer again, but she said, no way. So he married another actress. I don't know her name. I don't remember her name. But she used to do Broadway shows, and my ex-father-in-law used to work in Broadway. And he said he was the most vicious, vile man to his wife. He would call her the most vile names and treat her like she was dirt under his feet. So
you're talking about Rex.
Rex, yeah. So who knows? I mean,
Well, I've heard a lot of bad things about him, too. You know, I've interviewed Kurt Kruger, who was one of the few people who knew Carol, and he said that, you know, Rex was really stupid. He could never talk about anything but the means of transportation. That's what he told me. You know, Kruger was an educated man, a German, a real European. He had a sort of contempt for him. But, and other sources tell you how nasty he was to women. But clearly he wasn't ever nasty to Carol.
Think he was?
Well, there's no evidence of it. There was this poem that I wrote about where she was talking about how guilty she felt about the relationship, which is something you wouldn't expect for someone who'd been, you know, sleeping around all her life. But she obviously felt guilty about, you know, the idea that he was married and so on. And, you know, just a sort of Catholic guilt, a more general kind of thing you tell your confessor, you know. But the poem had a certain sincerity about it. In fact, there's an interesting little story about that because I got the original copy of the poem. I made the mistake of showing it to Carol's nephew. And, these people were very puritanical. And so as soon as he saw it, he started to say that it, you know, how do you know that Carol really wrote that? You know?
Yeah, because it was a little lovey-dovey. For them, magic underwear and no caffeine.
Anyway, so he put it in the drawer, and I knew.
That was the end of that. So,
but fortunately, there was a draft of it, so I managed to. But, I mean, the point is that there's no evidence that he was ever hostile or nasty to her.
Yeah, so they were together. They were a couple, basically. She would have him over. They would, you know, Lily Palmer knew it. And everybody knew it. And we're going to get to the time where Carol, the final day, Carol's last day, which was July. She had, there's a timeline. She had a
July
party,
4th.
A pool party for dozens of friends, including Rex Harrison. She appears to be in good spirits. That's part of why people think that, you know, she wouldn't kill herself. You know, people who kill themselves are often, you know, they hide, obviously, their feelings. That's why they feel like they want to kill themselves for many reasons. Anyway, it was a night in a row that they have dinner together. She put her third room. Carol puts on a plaid skirt, a white blouse, and gold sandals. You know what I think? Because I'm so surprised about how many people know about her. But when you see this picture, which is famous, and I believe it was in Hollywood,
the one her
suicide.
Dead in the-
yes, and it was all plastered, would you think about, all over the newspapers. And we're looking at it today. And when I remember when I saw it, and you just see like this woman who's in this cute little plaid skirt with her little white shirt and her sandals and her hair and her little doop-de-doo. And it's just like, oh my God, you know, this poor woman.
If you notice in my book, I didn't reproduce that. It's obvious.
It's everywhere. My goodness.
Well, I just didn't feel it was appropriate. I mean, I wanted people to remember Carol. There's a shot of her dancing with Rex where she's smiling and he looks happy. That seems more important than showing that rather sad picture of her lying on the floor of her bathroom.
Oh, it just makes me so sad. And so they have dinner together and speculated that they argued and she... You know, he's telling her he's not going to get a divorce, whatever. That's a speculation.
It certainly is a speculation because nobody recorded their conversation.
Yeah, how do you know? And how did people know this real timeline? According to Rex, he leaves Carol's house at 9, but that other sources says he was there until after midnight. Carol, how many suicide attempts had she made before?
Well, I mean, that's another thing that we don't really know, but let's just say that according to some friends, she had done this a couple of times, that she would take an excess of sleeping pills and call her friend, I forget the name of the friend.
The one, Dick Hames' mom, right?
Yeah, that's it. And she would come over and rescue her or something, and then this time she was out of town, so she couldn't rescue her. That's certainly, you know, at least conceivable.
I believe that she could have.
It sounds a little bit... Yeah, it sounds a little manufactured to me, but, you know, how can we tell? I mean, the idea that she would go to the brink like that, although it was certainly in her character. I mean, she did have that kind of character.
Yeah, what'd she do? She packed up those two huge stuff of mementos she and Rex had collected. She had collected from Rex letters, things like that,
mm-hmm.
and brought it to... What's the man's name that Rex went to when he lived a block away from Carol?
Oh, God. Yeah, you're,
I can't remember his name. What is
it? I can put my book here.
Roland Culver.
Yes, Culver. He was a British actor who was a friend of Rex. But the idea was that somehow she drove there and left a packet of stuff and then drove back. I guess it's possible. It does sound a little strange, and not you're committing suicide, but...
And it says she also leaves a note saying she's going to kill herself.
But in any case, well, I guess if she knew she was going to kill herself, I guess she was, you know, she wanted to leave these papers and maybe she thought that somebody would find them before her she died. But since supposedly she died at something like 3 a.m, it would have been difficult for anybody to find them. In any case, you know, one has to accept some of these things as true, although, you know, there's a lot of... misinformation, like people said that Lily Palmer was out of the country, and then Esther Williams said that Lily Palmer attended a party at her house that very day.
Yeah, Esther, that was certainly wrong.
Yeah, but then who knows, maybe Esther Williams was writing about this a few decades after the fact, you know, maybe she got it wrong. You know, you don't have any way of checking this information.
No,
and I would have had I would have been able to do better if I had written the book, as I say, 20 years earlier when there were a number of her old friends around, and I wasn't able to, you know, I fortunately was able to speak to 4 or 5 people, including Tony Martin, by the way, who, is he still alive? Well, anyway,
he died. Wasn't he married to Sid Charisse?
But he was still alive when I spoke to him.
Yeah,
and
he's not alive anymore.
He went out with Carol a couple of times.
Yeah, know. There's a picture of him with her.
Right.
So what basically happened, Rex left. They say he said 9. Some people, how did they know at 1? I don't know how anyone knows this stuff.
Well, didn't he go to somebody else's house afterwards?
Roland Culver, his
yeah,
friend.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why she dropped the stuff there.
And then he said he called her around 1:30 in the morning and that she was still alive then, and she, you know, she answered the phone. Well, I mean, I don't know. He could have been making that up. I mean, but why not, you know, why not assume that it was true? But, you know... Exactly. You know, being a detective on these things is difficult, and when you don't have any access to any information, including the police files, which as I think I mentioned in the book, had been destroyed since it wasn't a murder.
Right.
They only kept murder files. So, you know, you with all of the witnesses pretty much gone, and in any case, I didn't consider that the essential point. My real point about her and Rex, though, was that if there was anything that, you know, you could say about her relationship with Rex, it was that... it was certainly the most satisfying relationship she had with a man.
Which is sad, isn't it?
So.
Oh, yeah. So he leaves. She's awake for a while. She calls
Hakeem's
mom.
You know, he was going to go to New York. That's the thing. He got a
Broadway show, yeah.
A Broadway show about, what was it?
Oh, Anne of a Thousand Days.
That's right, Anne of a Thousand Days, about Anne Boleyn. And,
which is a great, it was a great movie with Jim Bourgeois and Richard Burton. Right. Great flick.
Richard Burton played. But, you know, so he, you know, he took that. I can understand that he would have been sort of relieved to be able to, you know, have a good excuse to leave so that he didn't have to be torn between
his
marriage.
Yeah.
Obviously... I mean, on the one hand, she was unstable and so on, but she must have been a lot of fun to be with. Everyone talks about how intelligent and witty she was, and she's full of life, and I imagine she was probably, you know, fun in bed, too.
Yes, and she was in love with him to the max, but, you know, they didn't live together.
That was the thing, you know, so when she was on, she was probably just wonderful to be with. But then she had a way of tiring of that, and then she became...
morose. She might have been bipolar. You never know.
I think that was, I mean, you could say that to some extent. I don't know if it was, what drugs they would give her nowadays. But, I mean, I think she had a certain bipolar quality.
Yeah,
she,
something that wasn't right in that.
She would be very happy and then very upset. You know, she had a depressive side. And so she would go from highs to lows. And
really lows, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know. So anyway, I mentioned the causes of a suicide. The fact that the Rex thing wasn't really working out, that it gave her a sense of guilt and also a sense of frustration that, you know, somehow this could have been my real love.
The one, yeah.
He's married and so on. And, but the second thing, of course, is that, you know, her career wasn't really going very well.
Yeah. In 29, she thought she was washed up and used up. You know,
that's why I was very interested in that quote that I had from what was the name of that woman? Edward Dimitrich's wife. she just died a few weeks ago. She was somebody who had been in A Million BC, and she remembered Carol telling her, and this was back in 1939 when Carol was 20, and she remembered Carol saying to her pointing to her bosom and saying, you know, I shouldn't live past 30 because at 30, you're...
washed up has been.
Your bosom will sag, and then you will no longer be attractive. And I'm sure you remember back in those days, the age of 30 for a woman was considered the beginning of middle age.
Right. Well, now it's 35. I don't know.
Well, now, 70 is the new 50. Whatever.
But I don't know if that's true in Hollywood, let's face it. But it isn't what it should be. You know, you can be like Clint Eastwood can be 80 and have a 40-year-old girlfriend, but, please.
Well, some women age better than others, like, Catherine Deneuve still looks pretty good.
But they're not going to hire her to play a sex symbol and a love interest or anything like that anymore. So, but there are a lot of...
I wouldn't say sex symbols, but she does play...
character roles now.
Roles that have at least some kind of sexiness about them. I saw her not that long ago in a movie where she plays a sort of... sexy mother figure and so on. Then again, I also saw Hana Shigula. Do you know who she
was? Yes. Mm-hmm.
No, she was really beautiful in her younger days, but she's playing this sort of an old woman. You know, it's kind of sad to see a woman who used to be so beautiful as just an old, you know, an old woman.
Well, I admire them, the ones that don't do the plastic surgery, because they still work. Whereas somebody like Goldie Hawn, who's 70 now and still has her hair the same, you know, and whatever, more power to you, but you're not going to work. But, and you're not going to be 20. You're still going to be 70 with a facelift. So there's some women who just don't do the road work at all. And, I, you know, to think that she thought she was over the hill and it was downhill from there. Mm-hmm. Maybe she just thought she'd never find love, that she was just a loser in love and that would never, ever happen for her. But well, again, I still sometimes think maybe she was calling out for somebody to help her. Like, I don't want to die, you know?
Well, I mean, the two things aren't contradictory.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of take a chance. It's as though you're making a prayer to God.
Right.
You say, hey, God, if you want me to live, you'll, you know, you'll help me out. Or else, then,
Here I come. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a sense of kind of fatalism there, which... is perfectly consonant with her character, I think.
Yeah. And so she takes a bunch of pills, secanols, and they say it would, you know, she took, I don't know, I guess like 0.1% of what she took would have killed her. She really took a lot. She wrote a note to her mom, which was very touching. And she wrote a letter to Rex, which nobody ever saw, but it's true because Lily Palmer even said it was true. And they paid $500 to a cop who showed it to him to destroy it and to destroy other things. And of course, the studio got involved like they did with Jean Harlow and her husband years ago when he died. And we don't know what happened with that. But Carol dies. And there's that horrible picture. I'm looking at it right now. This beautiful woman in her bathroom, dressed and dead, and it's horrible. And it says Rex calls Carol several times. Fannie Mae tells him she's not awake yet. He finds her the next day.
Well, there are different versions of that too. Like, you know, this was one woman who said that he had been at her house, and then he heard from somebody that Carol had died, which doesn't at all correspond to the idea that he went to the house and went upstairs and the maid let him in and then he saw her on the floor. So, you know, I mean, in other words, was he the first person to see her body? Or
and then leave? Because this is what they're saying here on the thing.
Yeah, well,
the family.
He apparently left so he could call his doctor.
He didn't call a doctor for a couple of hours. He left and he contacted the studio. And his wife, you know, backed him up with all of that, that they were friends. But I'm reading this here, and I'm going to link everybody to the website of, course, I'm going to link you to Eric and his wonderful book. And the family here that says they all believe she was murdered. They do. We are 100% convinced that Rex is to blame for her death.
How did he get her to take the second all?
And to write the note to her mother and write that note to her mother. It says, we know
let's face it, if you look at, say, Fleming's book, it's generally pretty well researched, but it has no, there's just no attempt at, any kind of what the French call controlling sources. You know, like he says that she was really probably born, although her birth certificate says January 2nd, she was really born in March or something. Well, you know, you don't need any evidence for that if you just sort of assume it. And in the same way, her family, I think, likes to have these ideas about her because suicide's bad, and so you could say she's murdered, then you know, it's like a sin that she hasn't committed. But, I mean, it's rather absurd. Carol was pretty tough. Fair fight, she probably could have beaten Rex up. And the idea that somehow he was able to get her to take a bunch of pills.
Well, this is how they say, this is one of the theories. Maybe Rex put secanol in Carol's food without her knowing about it.
Oh.
He knew about her past suicide attempts and thought no one would find it odd. He had been in the house a lot, so he knew where the pills were. Another possibility is that Carol did threaten to kill herself as a dramatic gesture, something she had done in the past to get attention. She took the pills, then called Rex to save her. He found her, and instead of calling a doctor, he just let her die.
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of things one can assume, but, you know, the so-called Occam's razor, I mean, you can assume all kinds of things. Or maybe what happened was that she was sitting in her living room and a stranger came in and drugged her and then put some pills down her throat and carried her upstairs and put her in the bathroom. I mean, you know, you can
The mother's suicide, the road she... The letter she wrote to her friend.
Well, maybe they better do that at gunpoint.
This is one thing they don't know. If they don't know depression. If she was so depressed to attempt to kill herself or planned it, then why would she go on a big shopping spree and plan a 4th of July party with her friends?
Well, it's true that she was seen coming out of some stores the day before.
But maybe she wasn't planning to kill herself until that night with Rex. She was in a bubbly and radiant mood the 4th of July weekend.
She was an impulsive kind of person.
Yes. Of course she's not going to show it. And it happened, you know, they said her friends would have known at some point. She would have shown her true emotions to someone. That night she set on telling Rex that he needs to keep his word to leave his wife or they were done. And I think that's what he promised her.
Well, you know, my feeling is that people make too much of this because it's sensational. You can never explain these things 100%, and there's always some possibility that, you know, you can, you know, speculate about.
Maybe he saw her dead or she was near death and he left. That's something I could kind of believe.
According to the coroner's report, she had been dead for quite a while when he got there. So.
Well, he could have been there earlier, too. You know.
I guess he could.
I'm just putting that part there because I totally believe that.
Well, as I say, one can speculate about that, but I think the more important thing is to worry about, you know, the reasons for a suicide, of which I think the three that I mentioned are pretty clear. You know, the idea of getting old for someone whose whole life has been built around her beauty, I think it must be difficult. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. 30, it's weird. But you know what? When you look at it, it's so funny when they show a woman that's aged, and I think she's in her 30s, a middle-aged woman. They used to put like one gray streak down her hair. And they'd make any of these old movies, if you're in your 40s or 50s, they'd put you in such outrageous old lady makeup. So I guess you're right on there. So this is what.
I think that she felt that she was getting old. If you look at her movies, if you look at those English movies that she made at the end, you know, she does look older. It's also possibly the way that she's costumed. I mean, she's sort of made up to look older. But, you know, I think that she had aged to a certain extent. She was very beautiful when she was a teenager, you know. And so I imagine that she was a little precocious and that.
Yes, she'd been around the block a little bit.
Right. But I think it wasn't just that she was already looking old, but it was that horrible idea of turning 30 in a situation where her great love was not really working out, where her marriage certainly wasn't working out, and where her career didn't seem to be going anywhere, although she had a couple of prospects. It wasn't as though she couldn't work anymore. But, you know, she wasn't advancing, you know.
She really wasn't at all.
These rather obscure English movies were not, or even her Eagle Lion film, Out of the Blue, where she plays essentially a second lead. So, you know, she had various reasons not to want to go on. Someone so impulsive and so full of life was not someone who wanted to have an everyday banal life, you know.
No.
As though, you know, just because she could make a living and she wouldn't starve to death. I'm sure if she had had children, things would have been different. I think that was partly her tragedy. She was always very attached to her nieces and nephews. And even my friend Walt Ross that I met in Provo, who had been just a little boy when she died, but he remembered her as somebody who was very sweet and affectionate. And she always said very nice things about Dorothy's kids and how she enjoyed being with them and so on. That would have given her stability, but unfortunately,
it didn't happen. Yeah, she had endometriosis. What is it? Endometriosis.
It probably wasn't endometriosis, but in any case, she had some kind of a deformity. Some people say that it had something to do with the influenza plague, and that her mother had influenza, and that this had somehow affected her.
Your wife, her genital area, or her woman organs, her woman parts.
Yeah, well, it's a delicate. It doesn't take much.
Yeah, I just want to just do this quick one about the family. This is this is all their stuff they're saying. Carol was very happy before death. She had a lot of plans for her future and told her sister that she was going back to church. Oh, big deal. Carol was not obsessed with Rex and broke up with him several times before the 4th of July. That spring, she dated actor Turhan Bey and almost reconciled with Horace Schmidtler.
He was in a movie with her.
And, yeah, they put
was that. in that movie Out of the Blues.
And it says, Rex was married. He did not want to get a divorce. He was afraid that his relationship with Carol was hurting his image and career. Rex was the last person to see Carol alive and the one to see her dead. First one. After finding her, he left the house and waited hours before calling the police. Rex came to Harold's house that morning and told the maid he thought she was dead. This was before they found the body! Exclamation point. Rex claimed he felt a pulse when he found Carol's body. And the autopsy said she died around 4 a.m. Anyway, they covered it up. Poor Carol was dead. That horrible picture. I think a lot of people see that picture, and I think that's what brings people to be fascinated by her, because a lot of people don't know her movies, but I'm telling you, she does have a lot of people that follow her and are interested in her, and they should get your book. I'm telling you, they should.
Well, we haven't talked much about her movies. I guess it's getting kind of late.
Yeah, I don't think we have much time for the movies.
It's unfortunate. I think we spend so much time on this personal stuff because, so she was an artist of sorts.
She was.
And her movies are not the best. Some of them are worth watching just for her. And I think that's why I mentioned Having Wonderful Crime, which is a very minor picture, but... I think there you see a side of her as a kind of screwball comic that could have been exploited, and in any case is something really unique. That I'm not saying that she was the most beautiful woman who ever lived, but she was able to pull that off in a way that I don't think anyone else could have done, to walk into the theater and tell the girl in front of her to take her hat off. I think you just watch that and you realize
it's very funny. The whole thought of the scene. Well, you list all of her movies, and also most of them can be seen on YouTube, which I will check some out, and I will check the one out that you told me about. But, people really want to know more about the person than the movie because of her ending and how, it was so tragic, a 29-year-old beautiful woman, and she had the funeral, and then Rex Harrison went to the funeral. Not only did Rex go... His wife went, Lily Palmer. Can you imagine her having to go to that? Wow.
Well, a lot of people went to that funeral.
He had to show up with her because she said, and he said that they were only friends.
It took guts to do that.
It sure did.
But it showed also a certain loyalty.
To her husband, that's for sure. And to, I guess, their careers or whatever, but.
I've visited her grave many times.
You have, huh?
Where
was she buried?
In Forest Lawn in Glendale. And, her sister wrote this nice little
epitaph
for her gravestone. Yeah. Every year on her birthday, which is January 2nd, and on her day of death, which is July 4th, I send I ordered some flowers.
Oh, that's so sweet, Eric.
I haven't been there in a few years. I went there a few times.
But, your wife ever go with you?
Yes. My wife was she's been very supportive of this.
And I think it's great you did it. And I think this is a very good book to read. I enjoyed it immensely. There's so little info on Carol. He's got the info. He's got her movies. And there is a lot of great stuff in there. I enjoyed it. The book is called Carol Landis, A Most Beautiful Girl, written by Eric Gans. And it's from the Hollywood Legends series. And I think it's a fabulous book. You guys want to read it. And I will link you up to Amazon. And Eric, you are a fabulous guest.
Well, I'm sorry I couldn't remember every little detail.
My goodness, 10 years. Do you know how many people? I had the person who wrote the Mary Astor Purple Diaries, who I loved. And he wrote it about 12 years ago, and he didn't remember things either. So it's just like you get people who write the books because so many people aren't writing new books. So you have to go there, and, you know, you're not the only one.
Book I ever wrote, you know.
You did a great job. How long did it take you?
It took me several years. I mean, I think I began in 2003 and I finished it in 2007. I spent many, many hours in the library researching it and writing it up, and then editing it was also a big thing because they made me take out a lot of the detail and, you know, the maximum length ought to be fairly short and so on. But, you know, I'm pretty happy with the result.
Oh, it's a wonderful book, really. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. And there are a lot of great pictures in there that Eric got. And it's a really, really good book. And she was a beautiful woman, and she's tragic to me. She makes me feel sad because I think...
Yes, but the person, that's why. She's not just a sex pot. She was
of course
generous.
Not. And she seemed very kind and that she had friends and, you know, she did good stuff. But she had her problems, poor lady, as we all do, you know. But she...
Well, someone should make a movie about Carol. That's what I imagine. But somehow it hasn't happened.
I wonder why, you know, because I ask people who write these amazing books, why are they not, you know, movies? And I don't know. Why are they not seeing this? They just made one about Gloria Graham. About the film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, and, you know, Annette Bening starred, and it was a good movie, but I didn't buy her as Gloria Graham, but it was a good movie, and yet there's so many stories, like, this is an amazing one to tell. I mean,
I think it can make a nice story because it's tragic, and it has these moments of glory, like...
Yes.
Going abroad and meeting the queen. And
doing
so
all her wonderful works for the war effort. And, you know, she really was something else. And, you know, she makes me sad. And I wish that, you know, it's just sad. It's a sad story. And she was so young and beautiful. And she was not washed up or old. But for some reason, she just made bad choices. Or she didn't believe in herself or something. I don't know what it was. But
I think she believed in her star a little too much, and that and she didn't have any real strategy for success.
Yeah, you're right. Because, like you said, the other one's pretty driven. Look at Norma Shearer or Betty Davis or Joan or all those women. They were pretty driven, and they made sure they stayed there.
I think a woman like Joan Crawford, you know, but she didn't. Carol didn't have that kind of ego. I think it went with her beauty. She was so beautiful, she just assumed that, you know, that was enough. And she didn't, you know, she was clever and so on. But, I mean, she never had a strategy for success. She never thought ahead.
Yeah, you know? I think because you get so much attention for your beauty, you just figure, okay, it's going to happen.
Right.
And I'm so beautiful, I'm going to find the most perfect man. I'm going to have the most wonderful life, and everything's going to be great.
Well, fortunately for me, I haven't had that experience, so I've had to write books.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of us haven't, but it is a great book, and I thank you so much for being a guest, and I thank you so
fun.
Much. You see, this is your first thing you did, and you did a great job. Bravo.
I've been on the, you know, the radio talking about Carol. And
yeah, and you did great. You did fabulous. Bravo, you did a great job.
But you're a great hostess, and I really appreciate this opportunity to
talk. I'm so happy. I'm very happy to have you on. And, you know, if you ever want to talk about some Carol and some movies again, you are my guest. Be my guest. And that would be fabulous.
If you'd like to discuss any movies, I'm happy to.
I'll have to watch some, and then we can talk about them.
I also can talk about French cinema, but that's another story. Okay, well, it's been great. I imagine you want to wrap this up.
Yeah, so, we're going at hour 33. I think it's one of my longest ones.
But really?
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed it, because I think there's some really good stuff in here. And Eric was fabulous. Check out his book. I will link it up. And thank you, Eric. You were a fabulous guest.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, take care. Thanks, everybody. We'll be doing another show soon. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.
Crazy me, falling in love with you. I shouldn't be so crazy, but what am I to do? Crazy me, hanging around your door and asking every daisy to tell me what's the score. How did I get this way? I want to shout hooray. I'm just a crazy fool, I guess. How did I get this way? Didn't I hear you say something that sounded so like yes? Can't believe that what you say is true. To love someone so crazy,